My name, for those of you who don't know me, I suspect that's a lot of you, is Bryn Winarski, and I'm here to chair this session this morning. Could I just ask you to do one thing if you have not already done it? At least turn your phone on to silence, please, so that you don't interrupt everybody. This morning's talk on ethics will be slightly different. It's going to be more a panel discussion, and we have to talk to us Megan Fitzgerald, Rupert Waters, who's on the far end of the table from me, and Michael Dolan, who's closest to me. Megan practices as a solicitor in the insurance litigation department at Landers and Rogers, and in that she spent quite a lot of time working for the Legal Practitioners Liability Committee in relation to their work, and so she has a wide experience in the problems of the profession, particularly when it comes to questions of whether or not there have been breach of some of your duties. Rupert, I have to admit, perhaps a slight conflict of interest with respect to Rupert, because I've known him for a long time before he was even admitted to, he finished his law course before then, because many years ago, perhaps about 12 years ago, 10 years ago, he worked as a gopher for us, as we then called them, a dog's body in our chambers. Rupert did his articles at Allens Arthur Robinson in 2007-08. He practised as a solicitor in the Environmental Defender's Office in Victoria, where he focused on planning, environmental and administrative law matters, and he's now at the bar, and amongst other things, he's worked for the Victorian Court of Appeal as a research assistant. Now, Michael Dolan, probably particularly the solicitor side of the profession, you will be aware that Michael is the acting manager of the Ethics Department at the Law Institute of Victoria. He provides ethical advice to Victorian solicitors both and in Tasmania, and he's been acting, I think he's acting secretary at the Ethics Committee. And Michael has a very sincere interest in ethical duties. So I think Michael's going to start, then Megan's going to say a few words, and I think Rupert, we'll hear from them till about 8:15, comments, and then we're going into a bit of a workshop where we're going to throw a few problems at you, and we really do want your feedback to hear what you view, what your view is of the problems, and to particularly fleece out the real problems that the examples have. So without more to do, I think it's Michael who's going to speak first. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the introduction, Brenda, and good morning, everyone. It's a nice, bright and early start for us this morning, and a beautiful morning, if I may say so. Thank you very much also to Michael Green, for inviting me to take part in today's seminar. Ethics has always been and will continue to be a key part of our role as lawyers. We really need, as I say in my seminars, to have ethics hardwired into our DNA. It really needs to be part of us. Christopher Craigie SC, or Judge Craigie as he now is, a judge of the New South Wales District Court, was the Commonwealth Director of Public Prosecutions for the past several years until his appointment. And he's given a number of talks on this subject, and continually the theme that has run through those talks is saying what lawyers need to have is an ethical awareness. Now that awareness should enable us to recognise ethical problems that are sitting out there in a bit of a minefield in our daily practices, and enable us to take appropriate steps not to put our feet on those mines. At an LIV ethics liaison group meeting last year, these are meetings we hold about three times a year with some partners of some of the large firms in town. The President of the Court of Appeal, Justice Chris Maxwell, was the guest speaker, and His Honour, when he was a silk, had undertaken an inquiry into occupational health and safety in the building industry, as some of you may recall. And he made the point, he said, the mantra that came out of that inquiry was that if it can't be done safely, then it can't be done. And he said, transposing that across to ethics as far as lawyers are concerned, the same mantra applies. If it can't be done ethically, then it can't be done. Simple as that. And His Honour also made the point that Our ethical duties in that sense can in fact be very liberating, particularly for younger or less experienced practitioners when faced with difficult clients who are pressing them to do things that are in fact unethical. And the simple answer is, my ethics will not allow me to do this. I cannot do it. And so that was, I think, an interesting message that His Honour conveyed. Now, just reminding ourselves, and I know you don't need any reminding, but I have this little pyramid slide of what about our ethical duties. We have several ethical duties, of course. We have a duty to the court because we're all officers of the court. And as officers of the court, all lawyers are key parts of the administration of justice. We have a duty to uphold the law and an overriding duty to the court to support its delivery of justice to the community. We must always act with honesty, integrity and candour, and never knowingly mislead the court or allow it to fall into error. We must honour undertakings given to the court and comply with its orders and directions. But we also owe important duties to our clients and to our fellow practitioners. We must act in the best interests of our clients with due skill and care on their behalf and in a timely manner. We must keep client confidences and avoid conflicts of interest. And we should communicate with clients regularly. And I know that'll be touched on when you hear later a little bit about regulation. Now, as far as our colleagues are concerned, we should always treat our colleagues with courtesy and strictly honour any undertakings we give them. I still find it surprising that we have to have a rule that says we should act courteously. I would have thought that was simply a bedrock upon which our practice as professionals should rest. And remember, if there's ever any clash of those duties, our duties to the law, to the administration of justice and to the court sit right at the top of the pyramid, and they always take precedence over all other duties. Now, just to give you a little bit of background on what we do at the Law Institute in relation to ethics, we have three lawyers who work in the ethics department. My colleague Donna Cooper is the manager of the ethics department, and she's away for 12 months on maternity leave at the moment, so that's why I'm sitting in her chair. But we have two other lawyers who support me at the moment. Now, on the ethics department, we have a confidential advice line, and we receive about 3,000 advice line calls each year from solicitors in this state and also from interstate. About a third of those calls are on confidentiality, about a third of them are on conflict of interest, and the remaining third is everything else, and it can range right across the whole ethics spectrum. As I say, these calls are confidential between the caller and the ethics department. And we take calls from all solicitors, not just LIV members, but we don't take calls from members of the public. We also support the work of the LIV Ethics Committee, which meets monthly except in the month of January and provides guidance to solicitors and issues rulings regarding ethical issues. Those rulings are non-binding, but there is Supreme Court authority that they should be given great weight by the court as the considered opinion of a group of experienced practitioners. We also produce what we call ethics guidelines, which attempt to summarise important ethical issues for practitioners. These are approved by the Ethics Committee, and then they go to the full Law Institute Council for ratification and publication, and are then published on the LIV website. At the end of last year, we published new guidelines, guidelines on the ethical use of social media. We're the third law society in the world to move down that track. In 2011, the International Bar Association conducted a survey of its worldwide members on the issue of social media, and more than 80% of respondents said that they require ethical guidance in that area, and more than 90% of respondents said that they expected that guidance to come from their local professional law associations or from the International Bar Association itself. The Legal Services Commissioner and the Law Society of New South Wales are in the process of developing similar guidelines, but it looks as though we were first horse out of the barrier, and they'll probably use ours as a model and follow them. So you can see those up on our website if you're interested. And finally, we deliver about 80 ethics seminars each year, including in-house seminars and seminars such as this. The in-house ones we do for firms, tailored if they wish to their individual practice requirements. Now, as I'm sure all of you know only too well, there are often no right or wrong answers when it comes to ethics, but always lots of maybe yes, maybe no, and depending on your viewpoint. So I do encourage you to engage actively in the ethics conversation with us, which we're going to have in the second part of the seminar. Of the four scenarios, just so you know, that you're going to be looking at, three of those have come off our ethics advice line. So we have a huge database of material that's come into us that these are the issues that are actually troubling solicitors in practice. So these aren't theoretical exam questions we've thought up. These are actual problems that have come into us. Finally, if I just conclude by saying, if you have an ethical issue that is troubling you, there are a number of things you can do. You can obviously talk to colleagues, both within your firm or friends or those you trust, but look at the ethics section of the LIB website. It's quite an extensive part of the website. It's got a lot of useful information there. If you're a solicitor, you can call the ethics advice line. If you're a barrister, you can get a ruling or get advice from the Vic Bar Ethics Committee. If you're a solicitor, you can also request the Ethics Committee to make a ruling if it's something that is needed beyond simply the advice of the ethics lawyer to whom you speak. But if I can leave you with one key message, if you're not sure of how to proceed, don't wing it. Don't go it alone. Get some advice about it. Because if it goes wrong and goes belly up, it can have very serious consequences for you. So I'm sure all colleagues are always ready to assist other colleagues in that space and to give them the benefit of their opinions. So thank you very much, and we look forward to the conversation.
Megan, if you...
As a barrister, and even as a solicitor, I tended to deal with the situations where that have gone past Michael's point and where people have just taken the approach of just winging it. And I am here to just give you a brief overview of the system that regulates our conduct and deals with lawyers when they do perhaps take that wrong step. So the first thing to be aware of is the Legal Services Commissioner, and the Legal Services Commissioner deals with regulatory matters. So where a complaint is made about a lawyer, or where a lawyer's misconduct comes to the attention of the Legal Services Commissioner somehow, the Legal Services Commissioner will investigate that complaint, that conduct, and if it appears likely that there's a reasonable prospect that the Victorian Civil and Administrative Tribunal would make a finding of professional misconduct against that practitioner, then the Commissioner has to take proceedings or make an application for an order to VCAT. If it appears likely that there's a prospect of a finding of unsatisfactory professional conduct, which is a slightly lower form of misconduct, then the Commissioner has a discretion. And in a moment I'll go through a few cases and have a bit of a chat about how that investigative process works and how you might, if you're on the receiving end of a letter from the Commissioner's office, influence things to try and ensure that that discretion is open and that the Commissioner wants to exercise it in your favour. The next aspect of the scheme that deals with our conduct is the Legal Practitioners Liability Committee. Now that's the insurer of most Victorian lawyers, and the LPLC insures us against claims made against lawyers for civil compensation or civil damages in connection with the firm's legal practice. So that's negligence claims. It's not regulatory matters, it's not defaults, complaints, investigations, fines, penalties. So we're not covered, we're not insured if complaints are made against us about our conduct. And finally, the other current major aspect of the scheme that regulates us is the Civil Procedure Act. And I think many lawyers look upon this act with dread, but it really doesn't do much that didn't already operate. It doesn't change the obligations that operate to control our conduct. It just puts some emphasis on them and asks us to take a good look at our conduct in advance of issuing proceedings and as we go along. What it might have done is perhaps encouraged courts to think more about imposing cost orders against lawyers in situations where they consider that the conduct of a practitioner has been unsatisfactory, but it doesn't actually add anything new, in my view, to the obligations that apply to us. So now I'll turn very briefly to a review of a few regulatory decisions. So a recent decision in the matter of Legal Services Commissioner and Barrett concerned a situation where a plaintiff, a personal injury client, had had 11 previous lawyers. Now, that's always a warning bell for anyone in our profession, but Mr. Barrett was kind enough to take this client on, and it was a situation where urgent steps were needed in the client's case. Mr. Barrett had done some personal injury work, but it wasn't his primary area of practice. And not being his primary area of practice, he wasn't aware of the rule that prohibits contingency fee agreements, which is a very well-known rule to most people who practice in personal injuries and use conditional fee agreements. He entered into a contingency fee agreement. It wasn't actually a particularly harsh agreement. It was a 10% arrangement of any order made in favour of the client or settlement. What that amounted to was about $30,000 in costs, which in the circumstances of the case was not considered to be an inappropriate costs amount. But unfortunately for Mr. Barrett, a subsequent complaint was made to the Legal Services Commissioner, and the client took the costs to VCAT. At VCAT, in the cost proceedings, the cost agreement was set aside because it was void for having a contingency arrangement in it, and Mr. Barrett was ordered to refund all of the costs that had been paid. He also had an indemnity costs order made against him in the VCAT proceedings. And he subsequently got taken to the tribunal again by the Legal Services Commissioner for misconduct, which resulted in a further $5,000 fine and another $5,000 costs order against him, as well as a reprimand. So the moral of that story is, if you're going to work in an area that's outside of your area of expertise, think carefully before you do it, and take care in, and make sure you get some advice from someone who does work in that area before you enter into it. And probably a good moral as well is what Michael mentioned before, don't wing it, especially in circumstances where you are put under placed in a position of urgency by your client. The next case I'll refer to is Blazevic and the Law Institute of Victoria. Ms. Blazevic was seeking to have her practising certificate reinstated, and the VCAT made an order that her practising certificate would not be reinstated on the basis that she didn't have proper systems in place. And I'll just refer very briefly to the situation that was in place in her practice. An officer of the Legal Services Commissioner's office found that Ms. Blazevic had no filing system, no efficient filing system. Clients were unable to call her directly in the event of an emergency. There was no computer. There was a need to leave her home office to travel to William Street to collect mail, and there was no system in place to receive an answer mail efficiently. Her photocopier had been broken from being left outside in the sun for too long, and she had reverted to using the fax machine for copying. And then the fax machine had broken from being left outside in the sun for too long. Fairly unsurprisingly, her practising certificate wasn't reinstated, and the moral of this story is make sure you have organised systems in place. They will protect you. Mr. Dwyer was also prosecuted by the Legal Services Commissioner. Mr. Dwyer had breached trust account rules. It wasn't a particularly serious breach, but it was a clear one. What really caused him problems was that in the investigative process, he falsified some correspondence and lied to the commissioner. And this became clear later on and led to the commissioner taking a very serious stance in relation to him and prosecuting him, where he may have potentially got through with a reprimand and no proceedings. Mr. Dwyer did have an incredible history of serving the community and had worked in criminal defence, primarily doing legally aided work, for a very long time. The tribunal described him as having a poor income versus a large reserve of goodwill. So his penalty was not as severe as most practitioners in trust account and lying to the commissioner situations might have been, and his practicing certificate was not interfered with. So the moral of this story, there are two, and the first is, if the commissioner sends you a letter, fess up, provide all your notes, and be as open as you can be, because that is far more likely to get you through the situation without a prosecution. The second moral is, be a good bloke. And finally, the Legal Services Commissioner prosecuted three partners of the firm, Mr. Coldham, Mr. Brooks and Mr. Barton. They were having some cash flow problems in their firm, and they engaged in a scheme of withholding payment of disbursements, primarily disbursements to barristers. So barristers' fees, cheques were being written, popped in a drawer and left for a long time. And that was used to deal with their cash flow problems. The scheme occurred over 3 years and it involved 216 payments worth over $300,000. The tribunal found that it was a deliberate and long-term strategy and that the partners would not have come forward about it if they hadn't been audited. They were each suspended for 9 months and had to pay the Legal Services Commissioner's costs of $50,000. And the suspensions led to the firm, Anderson Rice, being closed down. So you might all be able to guess the moral of this story. Pay your barristers on time. And now I turn to Rupert to have a discussion about legal professional negligence.
Just before you do, Rupert, if you don't mind. I know a lot about that Anderson Rice case, and I just want to make one point about it because Megan's just mentioned it. I actually appeared for the Legal Services Commissioner, and we were having a lot of trouble to get the matter on for hearing. And in the end, we were so satisfied in our own minds that it was such a bad example of retention of money that we were prepared to not proceed with the offences that were based on the money being trust account money and having been transferred into the office account improperly. We just went ahead on the basis that it was misconduct to withhold payment from third-party services providers for the period of time it was, and the Commissioner agreed with us thoroughly. The VCAT completely agreed with us. It's a very salutary lesson, in my view. Sorry, Rupert. Please, go on.
Thank you. I propose to only offer a very brief and rather basic overview of negligence for today's purposes, but do feel free to just put your hand up and ask any questions if they arise. So, obviously, a solicitor owes a duty of care to exercise reasonable skill and care in the performance of their retainer, and that duty is the same whether it's in contract or court, but there are some wrinkles to this which I'll now discuss. The first is that the duty does include a duty to warn of inherent risks in the transaction. And the key word there, I suppose, is in the transaction. In Hayden and RMA, the New South Wales Court of Appeal held that you don't have to warn of the fact that the law may change, because to some extent that's always a possibility. Although it does suggest that where a potential change of the law is on the cards, you may have a duty to warn of that. In the English case of Credit Lyonnais SA and Russell Jones and Walker, however, the firm was briefed to provide and to write a letter to a landlord saying we would like to extend time to exercise our break option. Now, if you read the contract, you couldn't extend time to exercise the break option. Russell Jones and Walker just went ahead and did what they were instructed, and ultimately it became apparent that the break option, although notionally extended, couldn't be an exercise, and the client had to buy their way out of the lease. They got sued, unsurprisingly, Russell Jones and Walker, and the court held that actually their retainer had extended the warning of the fact that you couldn't exercise the break option in the way the client wanted to. So even if you're not retained to deal with a specific point, even if your retainer is narrower than that, you may have a duty to just bring that point to the client's attention and say, this is something you need to deal with. And going to the, that's confirmed also by the New South Wales Court of Appeal case of David and David, which we refer to in the next bullet point. Ordinarily, the scope of the duty is defined by the solicitor's retainer, as we say there. The Court of Appeal has recently, I suppose the word mused or speculated is probably appropriate, that there may be circumstances in which the solicitor's obligations may go beyond that. One we've just seen is the inherent risk, but it's not clear the extent to which the lawyer might have a penumbral duty to warn of other matters, as Justice Nettle referred to it in that case we have from the Court of Appeal there. But also do have a look at David and David, in which the New South Wales Court of Appeal rejected any notion of a penumbral duty. Finally, the scope of the duty is, or may be, influenced by the nature of their client and their degree of sophistication. If you have a client who is regularly in a particular line of work, regularly doing a particular kind of work, then to some extent you've got a bit of greater leeway in terms of the advice you give them. If someone, for example, is always entering into loan transactions over land, then it's expected they might have some familiarity with those issues. And both the cases there, Austrust Proprietary Limited, Nestle, and National Homes Loan Corporation and Giffen, Crouch and Archer, are cases where the court said, well, really the client here was quite sophisticated, and therefore we don't really think there was any negligence. Turning to the standard of care, it's that which can be reasonably expected of persons practicing the lawyer's area of expertise at the date of alleged negligence. So that brings back Megan's point about how if you are going to a new area of expertise, your standard will not be the standard of a person of your seniority practicing in that area. It will be a more general standard. Will be the standard of a person practicing in that area, not just a lawyer generally. An interesting recent case is that of Stambrandt and Hanscom. Now, Stambrandt was a former client of Isaac Brott, who was involved in a long and ongoing cost dispute with him. And at one point he briefed Chris Hanscom to act for him. A number of arguments were made, and ultimately what succeeded was an argument that the judge on the bench in the cost dispute had come up with, which when put back to him, he accepted. KP Hanscom did not raise that point initially, and the question was whether or not she had been negligent by failing to raise that point. And in this decision, the court actually said, no, she wasn't. She said, you don't have it. The court said, I believe it was Justice Ferguson, said, you don't have a duty to identify every conceivable point. Particularly in this case, where there were a number of perfectly good arguments, and the point that they'd ultimately succeeded on was totally novel. It regarded the application of the credit code to costs agreements. So you don't have a duty to raise every point, and if a point that you didn't raise succeeds, or even if all the points you raised don't succeed, that doesn't necessarily indicate that you've been negligent. You're not negligent just because you lose, obviously, but the Stambrandt and Hanscom is a useful case to be aware of. In terms of loss, the plaintiff must prove on the balance of probabilities that the negligent act or omission caused the loss. That's just in the wrong set nowadays. Turning to a couple of particular issues, we've got the issue of loss of a chance. If you are being sued for negligence, what will generally happen is that the court will conduct a trial within a trial to determine what the loss actually, whether or not the loss would actually have occurred. And this will involve assessing your chances of succeeding. So for example, if a claim becomes statute barred under limitations, the court will still consider your chances of success had that claim been able to be brought. It'll take into account a number of other things, vicissitudes are sometimes described as, such as lawyer's fees that would then reduce the amount of damages that would have been awarded in that claim, and it'll ultimately come to an assessment of what's outstanding. And that will generally be covered by your insurance, as Megan's indicated, but there is a significant excess there. The last issue I want to turn to is really one for people who do in-court work, which is the issue of advocate's immunity, which, as you'll probably all be well aware, is a defence that prevents you being sued in negligence for work done in court. Now, and some work out of court, although the extent of that coverage is always unclear. Now, in the past, I've said you don't really want to rely on advocate's immunity because the reality is you can still be dragged off to court and have to go through the whole process before the court determined that, in fact, advocate's immunity applies. Now, time makes fools of us all, and in Caram and Aloe Proprietary Limited, Justice Pagoni recently struck out at a very early stage a claim on the basis of solicitors, on the basis of advocate's immunity. So it does happen, but in the recent New South Wales Court of Appeal decision of Donnellan and Woodland, the New South Wales Court of Appeal, or at least Justice Beasley, said whether or not you'll be able to get it struck out will depend very much on the particular facts and really whether you can isolate the issue in a way that doesn't require additional findings of fact before a decision can be made on the application of advocate's immunity. So my advice is still not to rely on it if you can avoid it. That's really the basic overview. Megan and I have noted a couple of issues, or a few matters that we think are useful to be aware of.
Conscious of the time, so we won't go into too much detail, but you'll see on the final page of the paper that there are a list of common issues to look out for, and that's the sort of things that you should bear in mind to protect yourself against having a complaint made or being sued. So the first thing is lack of communication. It is vital. The vast majority of complaints, certainly to the Commissioner's Office, arise out of clients who are dissatisfied and feel like their lawyer is not responding to their calls, not providing them with sufficient information. And similarly, people get sued more readily when their relationship with their client has soured. So while I wouldn't say keep clients happy at any cost, it's always worth bearing in mind. We're getting a little bit of a wave from the back, so I think it might be time for a break, but we might leave you with the list, and if anyone has any questions in the second section, feel free to ask them and we can have a bit of a chat about those.
Okay, well, we are going to break. And I just say that in your papers you'll find two pages setting out the various scenarios that are going to be discussed. And I would ask you during the 10-minute break or so that we're going to have, if you could just glance over those. They won't take you long to read and to see what the problem is. So we'll now adjourn to about 8:15.